All right, welcome back everyone to the deep dive. You know how we do things around here. We take something super complex from the legal world and we break it down, make it interesting, and make it relevant for you, our awesome listeners.
Absolutely. Always exciting to dive into a new case and see what lessons we can pull out. And this one has a lot for sure.
Oh, yeah. Today we're looking at United States v. Cousins. And this case really gets you thinking about the Fourth and Sixth Amendments, you know, those cornerstones of the Constitution that we always hear about.
Yeah, for sure. It really highlights how sometimes these seemingly straightforward rights can get pretty tricky to apply in real-world situations. Like, where's the line when it comes to police entering private property?
Right, exactly. And then on top of that, it also digs into how a past conviction, even one that seems minor, like a misdemeanor, can have a huge impact down the road.
Yeah, it's like it might seem like ancient history, but it can really come back to bite you.
Well, let's unpack all of that then, shall we? Okay, so United States v. Cousins. It all starts with a pretty significant amount of marijuana. I'm talking over 500 plants.
Wow, that's a lot of plants.
Yeah. And they were all discovered at the Cousins' residence. But here's the thing, it wasn't some like big dramatic raid that led to the discovery.
So how did they find out about it?
Well, a utility worker tipped off the police.
A utility worker.
Yep. Apparently, this worker noticed some crazy high power usage at the property, way more than usual. You know, it's like when your electric bill suddenly skyrockets and you're like, wait, what's going on here?
Yeah, exactly. So
Yeah.
this ordinary observation ends up triggering like a whole legal chain reaction.
It's like dominoes. So the police, acting on this tip, they head over to the Cousins' property. And here's where things get interesting. They go into a side yard, and from there, they can actually see the marijuana plants through a fence.
Through a fence, huh? So already we're starting to think about those Fourth Amendment boundaries, what's considered private property.
Right, and that's where the whole legal battle kicks in.
Okay, so before we go any further, let's really visualize this side yard.
Yeah.
You know, paint a picture for our listeners because these little details end up being super important.
Absolutely. Okay, so imagine it. It's got this paved walkway, an electric meter, you know, the kind of the utility worker would check, and then there's a melon garden. Pretty normal, right? Now, here's the catch. The side yard is fenced on three sides, but it's open to the driveway, and that's going to be crucial later on.
Oh, I see where this is going. Open to the driveway.
Yeah, so the Cousinses, they argued that this side yard was part of their home's curtilage, basically that zone around your house that gets Fourth Amendment protection. And because of that, they said the police needed a warrant to even step foot in there.
Makes sense. It's like an extension of your home, your private space.
You got it. So they filed a motion to suppress the evidence, basically trying to say, hey, the cops got this illegally. You can't use it against us.
Classic legal maneuver.
Exactly. But here's the thing. The district court didn't buy it. They denied the motion.
So even though the Cousinses were arguing their Fourth Amendment rights were violated, the case kept moving forward.
Yes. And that takes us to the next part of this legal saga, the actual charges and the plea agreements. Now, Kurt and Bukola Cousins, they were hit with some serious charges, not just, you know, a slap on the wrist. They were looking at conspiracy to manufacture marijuana, maintaining a place for, you know, all the production and distribution of the stuff, and they even faced the possibility of losing their property through criminal forfeiture.
Wow, that escalated quickly. So
Yeah.
we're talking about some really serious potential consequences here.
Yeah, no joke. This is the big leagues now. Now, Bacala, she ended up pleading guilty to maintaining a place for marijuana manufacture, and she got sentenced to 5 months in prison plus 3 years of supervised release. So, not a walk in the park, but not the worst case scenario either.
Okay. But then there's Kurt. What happened with him?
Kurt's story is where it gets really interesting, especially in terms of the whole Sixth Amendment issue. He also took a plea deal, pleading guilty to the conspiracy charge. But initially, he was staring down the barrel of a mandatory minimum sentence of 5 years. 5 years, no ifs, ands, or buts.
Whoa. Okay, so before we even get to the Sixth Amendment stuff, let's back up a second, really dig into why the court said, nope, that side yard isn't protected curtilage, because that seems like a key turning point in the whole case.
It totally is. And it's important for all of us to understand, right, like what actually defines that protected space around your home.
Right, because it's not as straightforward as you might think.
You're telling me.
Yeah.
So there's a specific test that courts use, and it comes from a Supreme Court case called United States v. Dunn.
Okay, so Dunn lays out the ground rules. It's a four-factor test, and it gives courts a framework for deciding what qualifies as curtilage. And law students, listen up. This is something you'll definitely want to remember.
Absolutely crucial. Okay, hit us with those factors.
All right, so the first one is proximity. Basically, how close is this area to the actual house?
Okay, makes sense. So in the cousins' case, the side yard was right next to the house, so that was probably in their favor.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd say so. But then we move on to factor number two, enclosure. Is there a fence or something else clearly marking it as part of the home? And remember, this is where that driveway detail comes back to haunt them.
It totally does.
Yeah.
Because they had fencing on three sides, but that open driveway really messed things up.
Right.
Big time.
The court really focused on the fact that it wasn't completely enclosed. And that's a major takeaway here. Even if you've got some fencing, if there's a clear opening like that, especially leading to a common area like a driveway, it weakens your argument that it's truly private.
Okay, makes sense. What's next?
Factor number three, the nature of the use. In other words, what's the area used for?
So in this case, they had the electric meter there, which of course the utility workers needed access to. And then the melon garden, which, you know, you could argue is for personal use, right? Right. But the court basically said the electric meter access made it less private. And the melon garden, while personal, it wasn't seen as like a super intimate private activity, especially when you factor in that it wasn't fully enclosed and you could see it from the driveway. So here's what we need to remember. It's not just about physical barriers. It's about how you're using the space and how accessible it is to others.
Okay, so it's like the more open and accessible it is, the less likely a court is going to say it's protected. All right, so what's the final factor?
Factor number four, steps taken to protect the area from observation. Did the residents do anything to make it more private?
And it doesn't sound like the Cousinses did much in that department, especially from the driveway. Anyone could pretty much see in.
Exactly. And because you could easily see the side yard from the driveway, which anyone visiting the house could use, the court decided that it was impliedly open to the public. Meaning, even though there was no explicit invitation to enter, the layout and accessibility basically suggested it wasn't meant to be super private. So in the end, after looking at all these done factors, the court said, nope, that side yard doesn't count as curtilage, so the officers entering it didn't violate the Fourth Amendment.
All right, so that explains the whole search issue. But now let's talk about Kurt and that whole Sixth Amendment situation.
Right.
So tell us more about that prior misdemeanor conviction and how it all ties into his case.
Right. Now, this is where things get extra interesting. And this is a really important point for all our law student listeners out there. So Kurt had this misdemeanor conviction from way back in 1996 in South Carolina. Now, here's the kicker. He didn't have a lawyer during that trial. And even though he got a suspended jail sentence, meaning he didn't actually go to jail right then, it still ended up playing a huge role in this case.
So the whole question is, does the Sixth Amendment right to counsel apply in misdemeanor cases, especially if you don't actually end up serving jail time right away?
And that's a really good question. And the answer is yes, absolutely it does. There's this landmark Supreme Court case, Alabama v. Shelton, that settled this very issue.
Alabama v. Shelton.
Yep. Basically, the Supreme Court said the Sixth Amendment right to counsel kicks in anytime someone's facing the possibility of jail time, even if the sentence is suspended. Because even with a suspended sentence, there's always that chance you could violate probation or whatever and end up in jail later on. That means you need a lawyer to help you navigate the whole thing from the start.
So because Kurt didn't have a lawyer during that earlier misdemeanor case, and remember, he got a suspended sentence, the court in the Cousins case determined that this prior conviction was unconstitutional.
Exactly. It's like you can't just ignore a fundamental right like that, even if it seems like a minor offense at the time. And this finding, well, it had a ripple effect.
Oh, yeah. Tell me more.
Well, you see, that prior conviction, even though it was unconstitutional, it had been used to bump up Kurt's criminal history score under the federal sentencing guidelines. And as you know, the higher your score, the harsher your potential sentence. It's like those points you get on your driver's license. You get too many, and things start getting bad.
Makes sense. So because of this Sixth Amendment issue, that prior conviction was basically wiped off the board, and that's where the safety valve provision enters the picture.
Exactly. Now, the safety valve, and law students might want to jot this down, is found at 18 U.S.C. Section 3553, if. It's basically a way for some nonviolent drug offenders to get a break on their sentences if they meet certain conditions. And one of those conditions is having a low criminal history category. They need to be in category I, the lowest one.
Got it. So basically, by removing that old unconstitutional conviction, Kurt's criminal history score went down, and there was a good chance he'd fall into that category one. And that means he could potentially qualify for a sentence below the mandatory 5 years he was initially facing.
You got it. It's crazy, right? This one little detail about a case from years ago could literally shave years off his sentence. That's how important these things are.
It really shows how every piece of the puzzle matters. So what happened then?
Well, because of this Sixth Amendment violation, the court threw out Kurt's original sentence and sent the whole thing back down to the district court for resentencing.
They'd start over.
Yep. And this time, they couldn't use that old conviction in their calculations. They had to reevaluate his criminal history and see if he was eligible for that safety valve. It's a huge win for Kurt, and it's a great example for law students of how even a seemingly small legal issue from the past can have massive repercussions down the line.
It's like a blast from the past can really change everything.
Right. And before we forget, it's interesting to compare Kurt's situation with Bukola's. Remember, her conviction stood.
Yeah, why is that? Did the Sixth Amendment stuff just not apply to her case?
That's right. The Sixth Amendment challenge was specifically about Kurt's prior conviction. Bukola didn't raise that argument in her case, so her plea deal and sentence remained as they were. This is a huge lesson for all you future lawyers out there. Don't be afraid to raise any and all potential legal arguments.
You never know what could make a difference. Now, before we wrap up, I wanted to touch on one more thing. The outline mentioned another legal argument about that Cousins has made something about false statements in the search warrant.
Yeah, they tried to argue that the police had messed up the paperwork they used to get the warrant. It's based on a case called Franks v. Delaware. Basically, they claimed that some of the information the cops gave to the judge was inaccurate or misleading.
Trying to discredit the whole warrant process. Makes sense.
But in the end, the court reviewed all that and didn't see enough evidence to support their claim. So that argument didn't go anywhere.
Okay, so lots to unpack here. For our law students listening, what are the big takeaways from United States v. Cousins?
Lots of good stuff here. First, when you're looking at a Fourth Amendment issue, especially dealing with curtilage, remember that Dunn test. It's your bread and butter. And it's not just about whether there's a fence. It's a whole package deal.
Mm-hmm.
How close is it to the house? How enclosed is it? What's it used for? Did they try to make it private? And keep in mind that implied openness idea. If it's easy to see and access from a public-ish area, like a driveway, that matters.
And what about the Sixth Amendment side of things?
The big lesson here is the right to counsel is a big deal, even in seemingly small cases. Even if it's a misdemeanor, and even if you don't actually go to jail right then and there, you still have the right to a lawyer. And neglecting that right can come back to haunt you years later, just like it did for Kurt. As a future lawyer, always, always check your client's past record for any potential Sixth Amendment issues. It could be a game changer.
It's like the Sixth Amendment has a long memory.
It totally does. And finally, the sentencing part of this case, the big takeaway. Every little detail in a defendant's criminal history matters. Whether they had a lawyer in a past case, whether they served time or not, all of that can have a huge impact on their sentence down the line. So you need to be a detective, dig into their past cases, and look for anything that might help them get a better outcome.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into United States v. Cousins, I want everyone to really think about this. Tiny details can have huge lasting impacts. The layout of a side yard, a lawyer missing from a past case, it all adds up. It makes you wonder, what other things are we taking for granted about our rights that might need a closer look? It's something to ponder, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. It just shows you the law is full of surprises, and sometimes those little details make all the difference.
All right, everyone. Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive. See you next time.
Yeah, catch you later.